When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to the Hawk Week podcast. I'm Hawk Week editor Matt Appleby, and today I'm with Joe Richam from Q. And we're talking about Q, Plant Words, a book of 250 curious words for plant lovers. And that's by Joe and Emma Townsend. And Joe's a botanical horticulturalist based at Q, and he works primarily with temperate plants. And he's responsible for Q's living collections of grasses and peonies. Now, the book covers everything from arborita to the wood wide web. And so starting off, Joe, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. What's the wood wide web?
Oh, you've caught me out straight away. So obviously this book was a collaboration. So Emma is the expert on the wood wide web. She'd be able to tell you more. But basically, it's the kind of the network of interactions that go on between trees.
Brilliant. Okay. So how did the book come about? How did you team up with Emma to do this?
So Q actually had the idea for this book kind of fully formed, as it were. They wanted to do a book of plant words, an introduction to the words we use to talk about the plant world. And they just needed someone to write it. So they approached me, and this is the first book I've written. So they approached me just before Christmas last year and asked me whether I'd be interested in doing it. There was quite a clear idea of when they wanted to release it. So there was quite a short time period of how much time we had to write it. And I did, I think, 1 week of the amount of work I worked out that I'd have to do to get it done in time, and thought, no, absolutely not, I can't do this. So asked whether we might split it. And luckily they were very amenable to that. So we asked Emma whether she'd be willing to write it alongside me.
Brilliant. And Emma says, by the end of the book, you'll know significantly more botany than you did at the beginning, unless you're a botany expert, in which case, don't read it, you idiot. So it's aimed at amateurs, but you will learn a lot about botany, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that was exactly right. It's not for people who already know a lot necessarily, although we hope that there's stuff in there that you might not have come across. We tried to find the interesting hooks about each term. We tried to make sure that it was all really kind of very accurate information. So it's not a reference book, but we hope that it's a way to kind of to go somewhere where you can go, what does that mean again?
Ah, yes. Now, botany education is always an issue, and it's always something which is, there's a shortage. What was your background? What's your education, Joe?
Well, I'm actually a career changer. So I studied music at university and worked as a librarian for the London Symphony Orchestra for 4 years in the early part of my career. And I eventually kind of worked out that wasn't the career for me, particularly the aspect of working in an office. You know, throughout my childhood, I've been outside a lot, and I just found that I was really missing that. So I retrained. I put myself through the RHS Level 2 diploma, I was working kind of freelance alongside that. So I got some experience in wildlife conservation with the London Wildlife Trust, then worked at Regent's Park for a short while. And then I later did one of the year-long specialist courses at Kew. Kew offers a variety of training courses, one of which is the Kew Specialist Certificate. And I spent a year in the kitchen garden at Kew with Helena Dove, learning about everything kitchen garden. So from propagation to harvest to pruning fruit trees, all sorts.
Oh, brilliant. No, well, I visited Helena a couple of times last year and saw the revamped kitchen garden, but you were obviously in it before it got redone. So what was your role there? What did you do there? What did you learn there?
All sorts, to be honest. Helena's amazing. She really knows her stuff. So she was a great mentor. So I spent a year just working with her, really. So we'd do everything from propagation through to planting out to harvesting for the kitchens. At that time, that's not something that's happening so much anymore. I had the opportunity to plan and implement my own project bed. So I chose to look at plant proteins. So I grew some slightly more obscure crops like chickpeas and soybeans, lentils. I even tried my hand at growing some peanuts, which wasn't immensely successful, I have to say, but we gave it a go at least. And we did get a flower, so that was quite interesting. It was an interesting year as well, because that year that I spent in the kitchen garden was also the year that the evolution garden at Kew was put in. So what used to be the order beds where all the plant families are displayed was turned into the evolution garden. So as well as spending time in the kitchen garden, I was out helping to redo a whole area of the gardens at Kew as well.
Oh, great. Now, the plant proteins is an area close to my heart as a vegan gardener. So do you think that's an area that is developing? Are more people doing that?
It's interesting, because what I found in trying to grow those plants was that they're uniquely unsuited to the UK climate. They are possible to grow. Don't get me wrong. And there's a couple of companies who are doing it really well. But they're kind of they have this unique combination of attributes, which means that they're difficult. Or I found them difficult to do anyway. And they don't like root disturbance, so planting them in situ is the best thing to do, but they're also not frost hardy, so that you can't plant them out before the frost pass. But also they have quite a long growing season to mature properly, so it's kind of this combination of things, which means that they weren't the easiest to grow, let's say.
Oh, so double treble whammy.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh dear. Now you mentioned music. Now, I guess you and Emma have a lot in common, because Emma is quite a well-known musician, or in a musical family.
She is, yes. It was interesting working with Emma, because it was very much, we were both aware of this musical connection. And actually, the contact that we have at Kew Publishing is also a musician. So there was this kind of joint thing bringing us all together. But the deadline on the book was so tight that all of the conversations we had were just to do with what we were doing and how we were going to possibly get it done on time.
So you're going to form a band? You could have Emma's dad Pete on the guitar, and that would be pretty good, I reckon.
It's a tempting proposition. You know, I have heard stories about people practicing in the basement of the Temperate House in years gone by, so perhaps it's something we need to revive.
Oh, superb. Right, I'll look forward to that. The next one of those Kew summer events, possibly just starting up as a warm-up act. Anyway, to move on back to gardening. In 2019, you went to New York on a sort of scholarship bursary to do a bit of study there. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so when you study at Kew on any of the programs that we have, be that the apprenticeship, the KSC that I did, or the 3-year diploma, you have this incredible opportunity that is called the Travel Scholarship. So it's an additional 2 weeks leave that you can apply for to go and study something relevant to your course. Actually, staff can apply for it as well, but obviously it's more difficult to tie it into what you're doing as a member of staff. So being in the kitchen garden during that year, I wanted to go and experience somewhere where kitchen gardening was being used practically, I suppose. Sometimes in this country particularly, kitchen gardens have become kind of display spaces in a lot of places. So I chose somewhere where the food that was being grown was being put to use in situ. I'd come to know of this amazing place, Blue Hills at Stone Barns, which is a restaurant in upstate New York, a very smart restaurant run by a chef called Dan Barber. He's a big name, and his kind of thing is, as I understand it, is where he sources his ingredients from. And the kind of ultimate demonstration of this is Blue Hills at Stone Barns, where they have the restaurant in the middle of the farm. So lots of the vegetables they grow, even some of the meat products, the animal products, also come from the farm. So I went and I worked there with their farming team for a week, just to kind of get a sense of what they do, how they do it, how they can produce on a reliable basis for a very, very smart restaurant. And then because I had 2 weeks, I then spent the second week looking at urban agriculture in the city of New York. So I visited rooftop gardens. I visited an aquaculture center that was working in the local community. Actually, I meant to visit a fair few other places, but unfortunately, several of them fell through. So I also ended up just looking at botanic gardens and other gardens in the city. So I visited New York Botanic Garden, Brooklyn Botanic Garden, the High Line, Governor's Island as well. So I just got a really good sense of horticulture in New York City.
Wow, it seems like you fitted a lot in, and you've sort of taken and been given quite a lot of opportunities early in your career. So how would you recommend other people get into horticulture, be they career changes or just sort of young people looking for a job or a career?
I think the main thing that I found, certainly in my experience, is an interest. If you can prove that you're interested in plants, in gardens, it's not just something that you're sort of looking to explore, that you've really got an interest in plants and gardens. I think that's a really key thing. And obviously experience as well, getting as much and as varied experience as possible. I think the fact that I was simultaneously working for the London Wildlife Trust, just kind of hacking stuff back at sites around North London, you know, going in with pairs of loppers and shears and just hacking back at brambles that have overgrown. Simultaneously, I was also volunteering with the Chelsea Physic Garden, doing much more kind of horticultural things. I think that varied experience really helped, because the other thing that I found in the kind of formative part of my career is that you never know where your specialism is going to come from. I never set out to specialize in grasses or peonies, and they've just kind of landed on my lap. And actually, I found, as with most things, plants, they're just incredibly interesting, and you can kind of take it and run with it.
Now, we're talking of grasses. It's been a very dry summer last year. It's been a very wet winter now. There's a lot of talk about lawns and, are we seeing the end of the lawn as we know it? Are people now having wilder lawns? And can we grow different type of lawns? You're an expert in grasses. So what can we do to turf mixes to create a more drought resistant lawn?
I think there's several different things to think about when we talk about lawns. Drought and heat, actually, because heat comes into it. Grasses are split into cool season and warm season grasses, and it's not just the lack of water that's an issue, but it's also the heat. A lot of the grasses that we have in our turf mixes traditionally are cool season grasses, and as the heat starts to go up, as it starts to get drier, they suffer more. So that there's perhaps an argument to think about putting more warm season grasses, so the grasses that are native to more tropical climes, into our turf mixes, because they cope better with those dry, hot conditions that we've seen recently. That being said, a lot of those grasses can be quite invasive, so whether that's a good idea or not is a debate to be had. But I think then the second aspect of turf is how it looks. we perhaps need to re-examine how our lawns look. Something that is very much talked about, I think, at the moment is the idea of more wild lawns, wildflower meadows. And actually, these are really resilient, whereas a lawn that's cut really low and short is going to look brown and quite sad during those hot, dry periods. A wildflower meadow will still look quite attractive, actually, and they're much more resilient as a sort of ecosystems as opposed to a lawn. And the other thing to note, of course, is that whenever a lawn looks dry and sad, it's not actually dead, or most of it isn't anyway. As soon as the rain comes back, as we've seen this year, it greens up, it starts growing again. It just goes dormant while there's that period. So perhaps it's an argument for just being okay with things looking brown and sad while we have those dry, hot periods.
But playing devil's advocate, if you're trying to sell your house and you've got a lawn which is, a bit scraggy, long, wild, or else if you've got a lovely, nice, neat, green, manicured lawn, which is going to sell better?
Yes, of course. There's an aesthetic aspect to bear in mind. But I think, I like to think anyway, that a lot of people understand that there is a lot of input that goes into a green lawn. It's not such a coveted thing anymore, perhaps. I would like to think.
No, indeed. Now, just talking about selling your house and million-pound houses and all that type of stuff, which is what they cost around Kew. I mean, you've done a lot of volunteering, and gardening isn't known for its massive pay packets. So how do you cope? How do you make a career in gardening in London financially?
I was lucky in that when I was retraining, I could still do my old job on a kind of freelance basis. So I was able to pick up a fair amount of work that kind of got me through as I was retraining. And I had a very understanding boss at the London Wildlife Trust. I worked there for 3 days a week while I was doing the RHS diploma. But it's true that it's a career that's not the most monetarily rewarding. But I think a lot of people who go into it recognize that there are a lot of other rewards quite aside from the monetary, the financial aspect.
Now, great. Well, you certainly made it work for you, which is good news. Now, looking ahead, have you got another book in you? What's your next one, and what's your next career steps?
I don't know about another book. I'll have to see what Kew Publishing have got in store for me. Because they came to me with the idea, I haven't actually got the experience of coming up with a book idea and following through with it myself. I have some ideas that I think could possibly make it into a book, but actually my day-to-day, my job, as it were, is managing the collections that I'm responsible for at Kew. That's kind of my focus. And there's a lot of exciting things going on with both of those areas at the moment, the grass garden and the peony garden. So that's kind of my focus, certainly for the months and maybe even years ahead.
So what's new in the grass garden and the peony garden?
So the peony garden, we're kind of halfway through a large-scale redevelopment of the whole collection. Kew's got a really long association with peonies. We were the place that the first tree peony came from China to the West in the 18th century, and that kind of that association with firsts and peonies has gone on through the years. In the kind of 90s, there was an area set aside to house our peony collection to display it. But over the intervening years, it's kind of lost its focus a little bit. The peonies have been overtaken by other herbaceous perennials. We've lost some of the collections, unfortunately, to disease, to environmental damage. So we needed to have a bit of a look at it. So last autumn, so autumn 2021, we started this large-scale project. I've dug up almost all of the peonies in the garden, which numbers I think over 250 so far that I've lifted and moved, and we've rearranged them to better suit the peonies, but also to be able to better tell the story that we want to tell with them. So there's lots going on in the peony garden, and then the grass garden, which I think is a real favourite for lots of visitors at Kew, particularly this time of year. We're kind of just trying to get that back into a really good shape. There's a problem with grasses, I think, is that they seed very readily and they also run very readily. So trying to keep all the grasses into the clump where they should be and keep them separate is a real challenge. And we're just trying to remedy some that have escaped somewhat.
No, well, good stuff. Now, peonies and grasses, do you have a favourite variety of either of them and a favourite supplier even?
Well, my focus is on trying to increase the amount of plants that we have from natural sources. So the peonies particularly, that's the kind of aim that I have for that collection. We do have quite a good selection of cultivars, particularly historical cultivars. But my aim, like I say, is to try and up the amount of species plants, those plants that you'd find in the wild, because some of them are just absolutely fantastic. A particular favorite of mine is a species called Peonia tenuifolia, and it's got these tiny, fine, dissected little leaves and these perfect red flowers. It's just a really lovely little plant, and it all the more amazing that you would find it in the wild, that you could be out on a walk in the right place at the right time and you'd come across this just, you know, on the side of the path. So I'd say that was a real favorite of mine.
Well, I hope I haven't stolen your thunder here, because at the end of every Hawk Week podcast we ask our lovely guests what their desert island plant is, what their plant is that they would take away if they could take no other. So Joe, have you got one?
I think, well, given that I've gone with a peony already, I think I'll have to say a grass. And the one that always comes to mind, it's not really a widely cultivated grass, but we have a specimen in the grass garden at Kew. It's a South African veld grass called Murx muellera macawenii. And when it's doing its thing, kind of early summer, it is just the most incredible thing to look at. It's an evergreen grass, so it keeps its foliage throughout the year. And for a lot of that year, it doesn't look all that much. It's got a nice habit, it kind of spreads well. But then it flowers in early summer and it puts out these amazing inflorescences. Not much to look at up close, but they've got this really lovely buff colour and it looks like a firework going off. It's really lovely.
Great choice. Now, thanks very much to Joe Richam, the author of Kew Plant Words, a book of 250 curious words for plant lovers. I'm Matthew Appleby, Hawk Week editor, and this has been the Hawk Week podcast. Make sure you never miss a Hawk Week podcast. Subscribe to or follow Hawk Week podcasts via Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. So once again, thanks to Joe from Kew, and see you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.